Well, good morning. For those of you who are less familiar with me, I'm Glenn Robitaille, and I was a pastor at Covenant when it launched in June of 1980 until I moved stateside in 1993, August of 93, actually. And currently, I'm the Director of Ethics and Spiritual Care and of the Ontario Structured Psychotherapy Program for North Simcoe Muskoka at Waypoint. Before I get into my message, I'm just going to thank a few people. I think that's appropriate, beginning with my wife, Debbie, for living this long journey with me and, you know, really being the pastor for all of the children at our church. I'd like to thank my kids, Joel, Amy, Joshua, Sherry, and Desiree for all the sacrifices you've made having a pastor as a father. Let me tell you, for those of you who don't know, that's no easy task. So fully resonate with your kids, John. And I'd like to thank also my parents, Bob and Rita Robitaille, for risking everything by supporting me in this vision, as well as Dave and Doris Webster, who were also under significant pressure to not participate, who along with Debbie and me and my folks envisioned and executed this congregation. I also want to thank Dale and Anne-Marie Shaw, who saw in a young 24-year-old maverick at the time the potential to actually pull something like this off, and as well, Harvey and Irma Sider. Harvey was the bishop of the Canadian Conference at the time, who found us funding and support at the conference level that enabled us to begin this work. And finally, I want to thank all of you for the privilege of being a part of this work for the last 40 years, with that 8-year hiatus while I pastored the Ashland, Ohio congregation for most of that time. And for about a year, I was filling in at the Ravenna Church. All told, I was a congregational pastor for 22 years before fully moving over to the field of spiritual care to engage one of the most enduring passions of my life, that being the support and care of individuals who struggle with issues of mental health. So I could easily talk for hours on what it meant to us who are a part of that planting experience, but I'm not going to do that today. As meaningful as that story is to me, and for those of us who were there, I'm not going to talk about those things today, but would rather share the thoughts, some thoughts I have around the present moment and what it may mean for our future. And if you really are interested in knowing the story of the founding of Covenant, I would invite you to read and walk with them the history of Covenant that John has referenced earlier. So it goes without saying that we're living in a time when all aspects of our emotional and spiritual well-being are being taxed and challenged. No one is getting a hall pass right now or a get-out-of-jail-free card or the opportunity to enact any geographic cure. You know, as a congregation and as a world, we are facing, as Aldous Huxley described it, a brave new world. And as much as we're all in it together, you've heard that repeatedly, you know, in commercials, everyone's using that phrase, we're all in it together, but you know, as much as we are, there are aspects of it that have to be faced alone. Issues of personal security and happiness are at stake, and every one of us has to face those realities individually. But here's the thing about such things. First, we know that happiness really has little to do with our circumstances. By and large, and on the whole, people who have had every conceivable advantage are generally no happier than those who have virtually nothing. We also know that people who are experiencing no real tension in their lives are often no more content than those who carry tremendous responsibilities and burdens. And at the same time, we know that there are people who, in spite of some unimaginable circumstances, are able to maintain cheerfulness, while others seem to be miserable in spite of what others might see as privilege and every possible opportunity and advantage. So emotional health is not necessarily a matter of being cheerful, although the scriptures do say that it's one of the obvious indicators that generally things are going well inside. I love the verse from Proverbs chapter 17, verse 22, that says, "A cheerful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones." And there are about 10 other proverbs that make similar comments and express similar sentiments. So yes, cheerfulness is a strong indicator of well-being, but it's not the key indicator. What researchers have identified as being that key indicator is something called resilience. It's all about how quickly you bounce back when you're experiencing disappointment or when things come into your life. And it's not really a matter of what you experience, but how well you are able to process what you experience. The other thing is that some researchers have taught that resilience is innate, that it's part of human personality. You either have it or you don't have it. And while I would agree that personality does factor into it in a big way, I know for certain that skills that bring resilience can be taught. I know they can be because I've had to learn them over the years. And I have taught resilience skills for most of my career. So yes, they can be taught. When I think of resilience, it reminds me of Itzhak Perlman. I'm sure you've heard about him. He's a concert violinist and one of the best in the world. I've spoken with him about him in the past. What strikes me about him is here's a guy who has braces on his legs. He has to walk with two crutches. And so just getting on the stage for this person is a huge ordeal. And then once he's on stage, in order to be comfortable, he has to take them off. And then, you know, he begins that long, slow process of getting himself prepared. And after doing that, during one particular concert at the Lincoln Center in New York City, he was barely underway, and I'm not sure which string he broke, but one of the strings broke, and it did so in such dramatic fashion that everybody in the auditorium knew that he had just done that. Now, being a guitar player, I have some idea of what recomposing and rethinking it would take to play that way. So I'm quite surprised that he just carried right on as if nothing had happened. It would be kind of like if you're a pianist trying to play with a whole octave of keys stuck. It can be done. People certainly who are really good on the piano and do well adjusting in the middle of a crisis probably can do it. But he certainly did. And when the concert ended, this is the part that really strikes me. When the concert was completed, he motioned to the audience and he said, "Sometimes it's the artist's task to find out how much music you can still make with what you have left." I absolutely love that statement because that's what resilience is. Resilience is the ability to continue making music with whatever it is you have left. Now, perhaps you've heard of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her five stages of grief. These were really popular back in the 1960s, probably rolled into the 1970s as well. She had studied reactions of her patients over a number of years, and she identified that there's some common elements to the grieving process. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And, you know, those of you who have worked in the field of grief and bereavement know that they no longer represent the gold standard in understanding grief and loss, but her categories still are relevant, and they do reflect a huge part of the grief experience for many. So whether or not they're the total sum of everything that is to be known about grief, it is, as Pink Floyd described it, another brick in the wall along the way. And although much can be said about those five stages, and I'll tell you a lot has been, how one knows that they are healing and ready to move on when they've come to that place of acceptance that she describes is when they can ask, "I don't have what I once had, but what do I have left?" That's the shift. I don't have what I once had, but what do I have left? When healing is gaining momentum, a conscious shift appears in the perspective that moves us away from the past to the present and the future. Emotional health is all about being able to get beyond the disappointments and the frustrations of our lives to what is this moment really about? And as she would have put it, what do I have left? Our emotional health and well-being is directly related to being able to do that. And the alternative to doing that is to be resigned to our circumstances. And there's a profound difference between resilience and resignation. When we talk about resignation, that's all about giving up or giving in, you know, throwing up your hands, throwing in the towel, however you want to describe that. Resilience is about getting up and carrying on. And I want to strongly emphasize that point today because, you know, the content of our lives is largely outside of our control. We can't always control whether our circumstances are pleasant or whether things are going well in our relationships or whether or not people live or die or whether or not we make enough money to meet all of the expectations and the desires of our lives. You know, other people often have a lot to say about those things. And right now, COVID-19 is having a lot to say about all of it all around the world. So here, we've been meeting online for months now, and I would say doing it quite effectively thanks to the hard work of our pastor and those who've supported his technological needs. But that is a challenge. It's different. Some of it has actually been better than before, as far as I'm concerned. Obviously not ideal. Face-to-face is, you know, having a human being in front of you is ideal. What we can control, though, to some degree, is how we allow those realities to impact our moods and our perspective on life. Now, there's a popular Christian book on overcoming depression that's been out now since the 90s, aptly named Happiness is a Choice by Frank Minnerup. I actually had dinner with him in Houston, had a chance to discuss a lot of different things with him. And so he says happiness is a choice, and it's safe to say that that's true. Some people are naturally more gifted at making that choice too. And granted, denying loss and minimizing our challenges, if that's what we're doing, is no more healthy than succumbing to those things. It's more about keeping an even keel. In aeronautics, they talk about the attitude of the plane, keeping the nose slightly upward so that over time we can rise, or at least avoid crashing. Impact is not necessarily a choice. How we're affected largely is. So I can give examples of individuals who maintained a sense of well-being while they were in prison camps, in difficult marriages, people who survived devastating illnesses, and they do so by remaining centered in the midst of all those challenges and not allowing themselves to become distracted by the whirlwind around them. And resilience is the number one factor in determining that, whether or not in the midst of the whirlwind, we're able to maintain emotional well-being. It has little to do with how well things are going in our lives and everything to do with the choices we make in the midst of what's happening. And that's good news, because it says we don't have to be victims if we choose to see it all differently. So if the first question in emotional well-being is, what do I have left? And the second question is, what can I control? See, one of the liabilities of the way the mind works is it has difficulty accepting frustration. So if you're having some difficulty with that, join the human family. Everyone struggles with frustration. You can call it human nature, you can call it the curse of the fall, call it whatever you want. But generally, human beings want things to work out how they want them to work out. And when they don't, they can get stuck trying to make what they want a reality, even when it's simply not possible. So going back to this idea of grief, particularly when a loss that may have been preventable occurs, people get stuck. And they start thinking, if only I had done this instead of that, maybe I wouldn't have lost this or that. And early on, that script is very normal. Everyone goes through that semantic. But at some point, health requires the ability to refocus on that which remains. And in this world, even those who actually hold the reins can get stuck in this. Take King Saul as one example. I wanted to work the story of David and Goliath and King Saul into this sermon this morning, because that was the subject of the very first sermon I brought at Covenant, and still one standard by which I measure our success. And if you recall, Saul was the first king of Israel. He reigned during a time when the Israelites were in conflict with the Philistines. And if you remember the story, they would face off on opposite sides of this valley. And every morning, Goliath, an 8-foot, probably 8.5-foot giant, would march out to the center of the valley and taunt the Israelites to send out their champion, and, you know, promising that anyone who could defeat him would take everything. So it was a winner-take-all kind of thing. As you know, no one would go except for a young shepherd boy named David, who marched out to meet him and bamboozled him with a stone from a sling, and then picked up his huge sword and severed his head from his shoulders. And so the part of the story that is relevant here is that at first, Saul was ecstatic about that. And so he elevated David to a high position within the kingdom. But, you know, before long, he noted that David was getting more attention than he was. And so he began to plot to take his life. In fact, He was so fussed about trying to control the amount of attention that David was getting, he lost sight of the one fact in this whole scenario that he could control, and that's the fact that he was the king. People still saw him as king. When you read the story, David still saw Saul as the king. He reinforced it at every turn. But instead of doing what he could do, which was be the very best king that he could be, he tried to control what he could not control, that being the people's affection for David. A story that, you know, could well resemble some of the things we're seeing in politics these days. And as a result of that, he lost everything. Now, was Saul crazy to be jealous of David? I don't think so. It's human nature to be hurt when someone else is seen as smarter or better or more talented than you are, particularly if it's in your own arena. But what was crazy of Saul was thinking that he could change those things by tormenting David or by bad-mouthing him or trying to take his life. The one and only card he had to play was to be the best possible king he could be. And, you know, wouldn't have hurt anything as well if he would have celebrated David's successes along with the people. That generally goes well for people. The only threat that ever existed to his kingship was actually his inability to do that. And as a result, he was so depressed and anxious that he became vicious. And that's generally what happens when one tries to control that which is uncontrollable, rather than taking care of one's own business, as you become miserable. So emotional health requires we stay focused on that which we can control and make our choices based on that. It is simply not possible for us to have emotional well-being while we're fueling frustration, wherever that's coming from. And again, whether or not we do so is actually our choice. We can't control what happens, but we can choose how we're going to respond to what happens. I'm going to take a sip from my Browns cup. John introduced the subject last week, so I'm very comfortable doing that. But anyway, the final question related to emotional well-being is, what can I contribute? What can I do to make life better for others? Now, Covenant exists 40 years later because its members continue to make their contributions to the world. If that didn't happen, there would be no Covenant. And being a part of Covenant has always required sacrifice and contribution from everyone in his family. When you look back over our history, there's never been a time when we've been insular and selfish. We've maintained a desire to bless our communities and make a difference in meeting whatever need that has manifested before us. An evolving approach to what's going on in the community and how can we be a part of that. A variety of leaders and messages have emerged over time with a variety of visions and emphases. And like all churches, we've sometimes struggled to hear the gentle whisper of the Spirit amid the loud clamor of our own preferences. And we all have preferences, let's be clear about that. At Covenant, we know what it means to make music with what little we may have, because we have not had a lot at various points in our history. We know what it is to identify that which we can control and focus on that because we have so little control of anything along that timeline. And we know what it is to make the contribution that best serves the interests of the whole, as anyone who's ever had to swallow hard or bite their tongues and accept the majority decision would know. And when you're in a congregation like ours, where decisions are made that way, yeah, there's possibility for being disappointed with every decision that's made. We have just witnessed and participated in a marvelous reimagining of ministry that's made worship possible for these last several months. And it gives me real confidence that the future is bright, because we will have to reimagine many things in the months to come. You know, some things about the way we do things may never be the same. And that's always true of the passage of time, isn't it? But if we stay focused on our part and contribute to the common good in the way that we've been uniquely gifted to do so, we'll create an amazing future, and you know, we will will it into being. We've completed a generation as a congregation and have reached our jubilee. 40 years of caring, sharing, and serving as a congregation. I, for one, am happy that the three families that first met this Goliath, Debbie and I, Dave and Doris, and my parents, Bob and Rita, along with several other charter members, are here to see it. That's an amazing thing. God is great and God is good. And as we sang in our very first service on July 15th, 1980, to God be the glory, great things he has done. But today, as we celebrate this Jubilee, I want to say to God be the glory, great things God will do. Thank you for giving me the honor of sharing in this moment, for the joy of being a part of your history, and together, along with all of you, helping Covenant to be a light on the hill. Debbie and I are, and always will be, eternally grateful. Thank you.